Good evening, everybody. Welcome. I'm going to call to order this hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. It's great to see everybody. Wow, what an impressive crowd. So we're going to start, as we always do, a quorum is present. We're going to start with approval of the minutes. We have minutes in our packet from March 8th. Representative Bierman, you want to move the minutes?
Yes, Madam Chair. Move the minutes of March 8th, please.
All right. Thank you for that. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor of approval of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails. The minutes are approved. So, folks, tonight we are taking up a series of bills all related to emergency medical services. And the first bill on the agenda is House File 2736. Chair Becker Finn, who's here with us today. So the chair will move House File 2736 to get it before the committee. As I'm doing that, I would like to just tell everybody in the room that although this bill is before us today and we are intending to lay over the bill, which means we're not going to vote on it this evening, and just so you all understand, Chair Becker Finn and I are in agreement that the bill is not going to move forward in this session. So unlike most of the bills that we hear, when we lay them over, you may see it come back in an omnibus bill. Not this one, not this session. So I just want everyone to understand that. This is a very important issue. There was a report from the Office of the Legislative Auditor in 22. We emailed the link to that out to all of the members in case you had not read it. There was one on the EMSRB, the board that oversees emergency services as well. And so this is an important issue that requires a lot of discussion. And this is the beginning of a really in-depth discussion that we expect will continue over the interim and we hope will get a lot more attention next session. So I just want to make that clear to everyone. The bill before you is not going to become law in its current form. So everyone can kind of take a deep breath. We really want to hear a lot about the issue. We want to understand the issue very deeply and everyone's point of view. So we do very much appreciate everyone being here tonight. And I really appreciate Chair Becker Finn for bringing us the bill so we can start this really important discussion. So with that, Chair Becker Finn, I understand there is an amendment to put the bill in the order in which you wanted to discuss it. Is that the A3 amendment?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
And did you want to just say something about the A3 before, and I will move the A3.
There was just an oversight in one community that we just needed to update that statute reference.
Okay, so I will move the A3. Is there any discussion to the A3 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of adoption of the A3, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Chair Becker Finn, to your bill as amended.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I thank you for your opening comments as well. I think based on the tenor of the emails that I've been receiving since I introduced this bill, I do think it's important for folks to understand from a legislative intent perspective, this specific language that's in front of us right now, I have no intention of pushing through, and we don't expect this language as it is to become law this year. So everyone can kind of take a deep breath. However, I really do appreciate, Chair Liebling, you being willing to bring up this issue. So this was an issue that was originally brought up to me by my local fire department. I live in Roseville and am serviced by our Roseville Fire Department. And also, we live on a route where we see ambulances all the time. And I've done several ride-alongs with my fire department, and has been an eye-opening experience. I encourage members, if you have not done a ride-along with your local fire department, to do that. You really will learn some things you didn't realize you were going to learn. And I had a lot of questions about why things happened the way they happened when I was on those calls. And dug into it deeper, started reading into the OLA report. I realized it's a lot. There's two different reports, and it's a lot of so we got there's two of them. So I realized, you know, in preparing for this hearing on the second to last week before second deadline, you probably didn't take the time to read through all of those. So I do think if I could direct members' attention, really the heart of why we're here and why there's a bill in front of us and why I wanted to lift up this conversation is this January 2023 update on emergency ambulance services from the Office of the Legislative Auditor. And it speaks to the larger issues that are in that report as far as insufficient oversight, outdated service areas, sustainability challenges. And on the bottom, when it says actions needed, it says legislative changes. And, you know, I know there are not a lot of members that were excited to jump into a very complicated, you know, heated sort of area. I know that that's why this room is full, because there are strong feelings about a lot of issues that are covered in this bill. But I did think it was important to move this conversation forward and start to lift it up and have a public discussion and be able to hear from the communities, from the folks who serve our communities about why this is important. And I'll just share as well that I grew up in a rural area. I am familiar with rural ambulance services, familiar with some of the challenges. I had a family member who, because of the time it took in a rural area for an ambulance to reach my family member, she ended up dying of that heart attack. You know, had things been different and things been carried out differently, that may not have been the final outcome. So these are matters of life and death. I know there are a lot of interests in various ways and various people and entities that are impacted by this discussion. But at the end of the day, my intent as the chief author of the bill is to make sure that everybody in our state can be served by these systems and has an equal access to the medical care that they need in an emergency. That really is the heart of why I'm here and why I agreed to carry this bill and have this really public conversation about it. And so with that, I know it's a very busy day. I'm actually supposed to be in two different committees in addition to this one. So I think it really would be important, I think, to hear the voices and hear from my testifiers as we move this forward.
Right. And Chair Bickerman, did you want to just tell us for a moment, kind of, I know that's a very complicated issue, and this is one of the reasons I think that OLA report is really, the OLA did a great service to us just by describing the system, which is something that is good. Often, if members haven't seen a lot of those reports, that's often what they do. That's very, very helpful. So I really would encourage every member, if you haven't already, to read that report, just so you understand how this all works. But Chair Bickerman, did you want to just give us a moment on kind of the approach that your bill takes?
Yeah, so thank you, Madam Chair. So, I mean, I think, again, we could get deep into the weeds on any certain section of this bill, and certainly some of the emails I've received, folks are willing to get into the weeds with the language. But I think the most important thing is it's addressing the underlying statutes that direct the EMSRB as to what they're supposed to do and what their role is. And so it's requiring that they adopt rules modifying boundaries of primary service areas. You know, that's sort of, I think, the core thing, and probably why at least most of the contact and the folks who are reaching out to me are concerned about that. And if we change that, what does that look like? But right now, there aren't sort of standards for the care that folks receive, how quickly things happen. All those things really need more oversight. So it's not necessarily us prescriptively explaining everything in detail, but directing the board who oversees this to take some additional action and setting some of those sort of guardrails that don't currently exist in our statute related to emergency ambulance services.
Okay, thank you so much. So we do have quite a list of testifiers, and so we're going to ask everybody to testify for no more than 2 minutes. We will time you, of course. We won't cut you off at two, but, you know, we'd ask you to finish your sentence. And I really appreciate everybody being here today to talk about this very important subject. So first on the list is B.J. Jungman, if you're here. And here he comes. And then after him is, I have David Brosnahan, and then Andrew Stevens, just so you can be ready. So welcome to the committee. If you would, and same for everybody, when you come up to the table, just give your name, you know, introduce yourself with your affiliation, and then go ahead and give your testimony. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, for allowing me to testify. I am B.J. Jungman, and I serve as the fire chief for the city of Burnsville and the chair of the Minnesota Fire Association Coalition, which is the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association, the Fire Department Association, the fire marshals and arson investigators. Thank you for hearing House File 2736. We appreciate Representative Becker Finn's work to author this bill and the committee to hear the bill. One item identified in the OLA report and reemphasized in the update earlier in 2023, there are several aspects of the OLA report, and the restructuring of the primary service areas with House File 2736 represents just one of those pieces. There are other bills bringing forward other recommendations. We're bringing one solution forward for local input identified in the OLA report and know there's more work to be done and that this is not a perfect solution. We want increased transparency and accountability for EMS by local units of government. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. Locally elected officials are in the best position to determine the right level of service for their community. They provide fire protection in all communities without a mandate. It's my experience also that equity in a community is best positioned to be determined by the community that engage their residents to find out what their needs are. Communities know what their needs are, not corporations. You will hear scare tactics such as big profit companies will come in. We already have for-profit companies. All licenses are currently for sale. Health East and Fairview merged, and that was handled as a name change by the current regulatory board without any local input, and now we're looking at Sanford acquiring mHealth. When you compare this to public utilities, we have control over charges, reliability, quality, and timeliness. We have more control over our trash collection and cable provision in cities than ambulance services. The current system is unregulated and the unregulated monopoly, and the only regulation that exists is currently by the industry itself. You would not allow 80% of your public utility commission to be made up of utility companies themselves. A lot has changed in four decades, but EMS regulation has not. Thank you for your time and consideration on this important matter.
All right, thank you for your testimony. David Brosnahan. And then Andrew Stevens and John Swenson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good evening. My name is David Brosnahan. I'm a member of the Minnesota Fire Chiefs Association Legislative Committee and the Fire Chief for the City of Roseville. In my role as the Fire Chief, my number one priority is and always will be the health and safety of my community. That is why in August 2022, due to increasing response times and the swelling of mutual aid utilization of our PSA ambulance provider, my fire department transitioned our level of emergency first response care from basic life support, or EMT level, to the advanced life support paramedic level. The response delays were widening the gap of higher level care, and my organization needed to close that gap. This enhancement of service has a cost and operational impact, but my community has supported it. This isn't just a Roseville and Metro issue. Fire chiefs across the state are experiencing elongated response times, ambulances showing up with only one provider, expecting the fire department to drive for them, EMS agencies no longer staffing an ambulance in their town and responding from miles away. EMS is an essential service in all of our communities, as EMS transport to definitive care is provided to all, regardless of insurance status. With increasing call volumes, ongoing recruitment retention challenges, the response model does not fully meet the demand. It is imperative to allow LGUs to provide their own authority and decision-making on appropriate service providers. In current law for ambulance services, there are no defined response time requirements, no quality assurance metrics for service, no clear performance standards or benchmarks. The changes suggested will allow for greater transparency, expectations for performance, allowance for evaluation of current and future service options, and reduces the significant inflexibility of the current law. This change further opens the opportunity for long-term public-private collaboration, even hybrid service models, which may work better for LGUs, private ambulances, fire departments, and volunteer EMS agencies. These changes are important for all Minnesotans, the actual user of the services, because in EMS, every second truly counts. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Andrew Stevens, then John Swenson, then Nick Simpson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. If you'd give me a moment before I formally start, I want to reassure everyone here, this is a room of family and friends. I've never felt so many smiles and felt so good about seeing faces as when we're all here, maybe outside of Thanksgiving dinner. This group, when something bad happens, can come together and make amazing things and positive come out of that. So please, I just wanted to share that with the group.
Thank you.
Chair and committee, I'm Andrew Stevens. I'm an emergency medicine doctor, duly boarded in EMS. What does that really even mean? My own father couldn't really explain to you if he was here what I do and how I do it and how this all works. So I say this similar to an orthopedic surgeon may be an expert on your knees. I am your guy for ambulances. I've been afforded a unique and additional life experiences, unlike many others, maybe even in this room. I've been a chief medical officer, medical director for large and small, urban and rural, municipal and private-based EMS services. Executive vice president leadership background of large healthcare corporation-based ambulances. I've served as an elected official. I understand what it's like to sit in that seat. I'm an advisor to the state. I've been boots on the ground, providing care on the street for 20 years. My sum of experiences is important because I understand the middle of this issue and talk to you from that vantage point tonight. When someone experiencing a medical emergency dials 911 in Minnesota, they are not connected to a hospital or a clinic, instead to PSAP, P-S-A-P, Public Safety Answering Point. Medical care is what is provided, but it arrives. EMS really arrives because it's part of public safety. It is a system that collaborates these people in this room, a mixture of police officers, firefighters, and as a pillar, ambulances to form a circle of care around a community member needing help in that moment. When reflecting on this, the importance of local community input exists in public safety through the police and fire services that we all rely on. The pillar of EMS, the ambulances, there is an opportunity for improvement. No one knows the community better than the people that live there and the leaders they count on. The disparities that may exist, equity and equality of the community members' unique needs, challenges, even the geography itself. We have accepted the importance of local control and agreements of public-private collaborations of our other public utilities, such as cable and electricity. It is a layer of accountability to be responsive, reliable, resilient, and really there when we all need it.
I have to ask you to wrap up. Two minutes goes very fast. I'm sorry.
Our ambulance system is more important. Minnesota can do this better. We can learn from the past 40 years. Legislation really is negotiation. I support this bill as the starting point place to finding the middle and the improvement. I count on all of you in the legislative process to take it from here. I appreciate your time and the job you do. 2 minutes is a short time, Chair, to share the full view from my vantage point. As always, I can be contacted at the phone number 911.
Thank you for your testimony.
Yes. Joking aside, I'm happy to meet with anyone that needs to have further conversations, as the chair said. Have a good evening.
All right. John Swenson, then Nick Simpson, then Marty Scheer. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Swenson, and I have the privilege of serving as the Public Safety Director for the City of Llano Lakes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House File 2736. The city of Llano Lakes covers 33 square miles and is located in the southeast corner of Anoka County. Our public safety department provides all police and fire services, with our police officers serving as primary responders on all medical calls for service in our community. Dating back to 2013, our community has experienced difficulties with the current EMSRB rules and regulations, laws governing ambulance primary service areas, which do not allow any meaningful input from local government or those that are included in that circle of service related to the emergency medical services. Since July 1st of 2022, our police staff have waited a total of 13 hours and 54 minutes for ambulances to arrive on medical calls for service in our community. This has created staffing challenges and delays in our response to other calls for service in our community, yet we have no ability to address those delays. I agree with the Minnesota Office of the Legislative Auditor's January 2023 update to their 2022 report, which called for the legislature to enable local governments to have input on ambulance services. House File 2736 is a good starting point in that dialogue, and we need legislation that will afford our local governments the opportunity to weigh in on this incredibly important issue for all of our communities throughout this state. And with that, I thank you for the opportunity to testify tonight. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Nick Simpson, followed by Marty Shear, followed by Susan Long. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Nick Simpson, and I am also a physician who's double board certified in emergency medicine and EMS. And I come before you this evening as president of the Minnesota chapter of the National Association of EMS Physicians. I represent the EMS physicians and other affiliated EMS professionals in this group. More than that, I come to you tonight on behalf of our patients. And when I say patients, I'm referring to every resident and visitor to the great state of Minnesota. This is not limited to any municipality or taxing district. This bill, as written, is directly contradictory to the recommendations of the Office of the Legislative Auditor Report on EMS. On page 24, it states that the legislature should retain primary service areas for ambulance services. Currently, there are 250 PSAs in Minnesota. There are 853 cities with populations ranging from over 425,000 to 11. Making PSAs individualized to municipalities and taxing districts will effectively remove the PSAs. There are large swaths of greater Minnesota that will likely go without any EMS coverage. We've already heard communities raise these concerns. I've spoken to many physicians about this bill, and I have not heard one yet that has said this is in the best interest of their patients or the state. This also does open the door to massive corporations who can come in to underbid existing providers, lower wages, decrease the level of care while cutting costs on medications, equipment, and supplies. There are many examples of this across the country. This bill in its current form will codify further socioeconomic and geographic inequality into statute, and Minnesota is already home to some of the worst health equity gaps in the nation. This bill in its current form stands to do lasting and potentially irreparable damage to the patients and communities that we serve. It's not about us, it's about our patients. This bill is far too important for our patients. We need to work together, and we appreciate the committee allowing us time to get this right and allowing us to be part of this process.
Thank you so much for your testimony. Marty Shear, Susan, then Susan Long, then Jim Reber. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Marty Shear. I'm the Senior Director of Hennepin Healthcare EMS. I'm testifying on the impacts of this bill on the emergency medical services in our state. So I believe I'm uniquely qualified to provide input on this discussion. I previously served as the fire chief for the city of Edina, which as an actually the fire department responds as the paramedic service transport. Also the city of Waconia, which is a volunteer service that relied on Ridgeview Ambulance to respond to us. I've also been the president of the Minnesota State Fire Chiefs Association. I've been president of the Metro Fire Chiefs Association. I've been a board member of the EMSRB, and I was the chair of the EMSRB complaint review panel. So I'm uniquely familiar with this issue. Virtually everyone in this room behind me is a friend of mine. I'm one of the few people in here that can say that, and they're going to be my friends after this bill is heard too as well. So there's many issues that are involved in this PSA discussion. This came up when I was the president of the Chiefs Association. We had a lot of discussion then. We didn't think it was a good idea to change the PSA model as it was, and I still believe that today. The bill would have detrimental impact to the both health equity, emergency care delivery, and stability provided by the patient population, patient's ability to pay. This would result in a system where lower income, complex needs, higher disparity, and low density areas could be left entirely without any care from the EMS providers in their area, especially the populations that rely more on Medicare. The proposed changes result in cities and ambulance being able to select affluent and densely populated areas and leave other areas uncovered, essentially cherry picking the EMS system. The goal of an effective EMS system is to provide emergency medical care to all who need it, not just those who can afford it. This is why we have the PSA law and why it was developed. I certainly don't mind tweaking it, but it's very important to have the PSA law. PSAs are at work because they're not a patchwork of providers competing for the best paying patients and ensuring that every individual is covered and all areas, including rural areas, are covered. So I've been in the business for over 30 years in fire and EMS. I can attest to the way our current PSA system works, and it's resulted in consistent quality patient care and stability in EMS services, which have undergone tremendous events like COVID-19, staffing shortages, fluctuating reimbursements. You know what, you'll some people say this is a broken system. I'll say it's not a broken system. It's a really, really good system that works really well. Can it be improved? Certainly. But many states will look at us as a model for EMS. And I will say there's some lengthy response times, but those generally are not for emergent calls. Okay. And if you read the...
ask you to wrap up.
Sure. If you read the OLA report on page 26, I'll read it real quick. In our view, if local governments believe their residents would better served by a competitor, they should be able to seek a change from their ambulance service provider. However, the ability to seek the change should take place within the primary service area framework. Otherwise, local decisions made independently by many municipalities could have a cumulative effect of reducing access to ambulance services in neighboring communities. That's a direct quote from the OLG report. So thank you very much. Please come on a ride along with me. Representative Herr, who's not here, but she went on a ride along with me. And you want to ride along too, yeah. So it's a great experience, and anytime, please contact me and we'll go for a ride. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Susan Long, then Jim Reber, then Tim Meyer, then Buck McAlpin. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good evening, Chair Liebling, and members of the community. My name is Susan Long, and I serve as the president, vice president, and EMS chief for emergency medical services at Allina Health. For the past 25 years, I've had the honor to serve patients and communities as an EMT, a paramedic, and an administrator. And today I'm here to share our concerns with House File 2736. Allina Health EMS has been caring for patients for more than 100 years, and we're proud to continue to provide care for more than a million Minnesota residents in more than 100 communities across Minnesota. We employ over 700 paramedics, emergency medical technicians, dispatchers, special transportation drivers, maintenance and administrative, and support personnel. Our services include an accredited emergency dispatch center offering 911 pre-arrival instructions, emergency and non-emergency ambulance response, our Greater Minnesota Ride program, and wheelchair transportation. House File 2736 does not address the true issues facing the EMS industry. At this moment, Minnesota's EMS providers are facing several critical challenges that threaten our ability to provide reliable services to our communities, including staffing and workforce shortages, a reimbursement structure that often fails to provide adequate compensation needed to continue to care for our communities. Eliminating the PSA law would only further destabilize the industry and could have some extremely negative consequences on the availability of services across the state. Allina Health EMS is proud of our partnerships within our local communities and remains committed to working together to solve the challenges facing our industry and our patients. However, House File 2736 would be incredibly harmful to the patients and communities that we serve. For those reasons and many others, I urge you to oppose House File 2736 and focus on solutions that will actually address the challenges we're facing, and we are ready to be a part of those conversations. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you so much. Appreciate your testimony. And just to reiterate, as the next speaker comes up, you know, we're not today opposing or supporting the bill, but we are grateful to have the discussion. So Jim Reber, welcome to the committee. And then after him will be Tim Meyer, Buck McAlpin, and then Robert Benson.
Welcome. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for having me here today. My name is Jim Reber. I'm the director of EMS for Perham Area EMS in Perham, Minnesota, and also the emergency management director for Perham Health. Our service is a small rural service. We do about 1,600 calls a year up in central Minnesota in the Lakes Country. We have a lot of concerns about this bill, the language in it as it's written today. It had a very negative impact for most of rural Minnesota. The rural agencies are struggling with staffing. They're struggling with management and oversight of the rural EMS systems. It's a crisis out there today. We've been 30% or more short on staff for the last 3 years. Unable to recruit or retain staff has been a huge issue for us, and that comes best driven from reimbursement. We struggle to recruit managers in the rural areas. A lot of our rural service managers are working 4 hours a week to manage their service. Their focus is on how do I fill the truck to have somebody respond to calls that come in. So we need help in those areas. This doesn't help address any of the issues that we're facing. Some of the concerns I have with this bill, the provisions will have rural areas left uncovered. There is not a mandate in this for 100% coverage, and I'll use our example. We are a joint powers board of the townships and the cities that we serve. And I don't have a lot of faith in the local unit of government always doing the best choice, because we have two that have not joined our joint powers board. And we serve them now because the PSL requires us to. But with this change, we would no longer have to serve the area. They would be left unserved. And their decision is, we'll take our chances, somebody will come. So I think the PSA law, the protection it gives all residents of Minnesota, is essential that that stays in place in some manner. We also have the concern in the rural areas if, for example, I'll use again our area, if Perham and Detroit Lakes, both municipalities, wanted to do the ambulance service and only do 911 calls, there is no requirement in this that for the rural hospitals to have interfacility transfer services available to them. And then as this law is written today, they can't have a second ambulance service come in because only one license is allowed per municipality. So it puts them in a bind where they have no way to transport a critical ill patient as this is written. There's a lot of work that needs to be done. We look at a lot of things, like in our area also as part of the requirement, there's only one every unit of government can only select one ambulance service. We have 1,000 lakes in Otter Tail County. So we've divided the county up using the PSAP data information about where the best response is based upon the location of the ambulance. And with that, our townships are split up and divided, so I don't have to drive around 8 miles around Star Lake to get to that house on the other side, because that's in that township. The other ambulance service is closer, so we've worked that out to what's the best response to have.
Okay, I have to ask you to wrap up.
Yep, that's good. You know, I agree there's many good intentions with this bill. The reporting requirements alone are going to overwhelm rural ambulance service. They'll just stop doing it. And then it's going to be up to the regulatory board how to enforce that, because they don't have staff to fill their schedules, much less all the reporting. We would have to do 17 different reports every quarter, where now we do an annual report to our facility. So there's just a lot of the details like that. A lot of the information about the PSA requirements, the laws, things like that, that we think that we could do a lot of work to help improve. But as the bill sits today, that I think that it just has too many negative impacts. Rural Minnesota won't survive through the change, and a lot of the state will no longer have quality ambulance service provided to it. We really like to focus on recruitment, retention, and reimbursement. If we can get reimbursement fixed, we can work on the rest. And that's where we feel the focus needs to be. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Tim Meyer, then Buck McAlpin, then Robert Benson, then Tim Melchow. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Tim Meyer. I'm the Senior Director for Sanford Ambulance. Sanford Health operates ambulance services in Moorhead, Thief River Falls, Bagley, Wheaton, Worthington, Laverne, and Canby. Prior to becoming part of the Sanford system, ambulance services in Bagley, Wheaton, Laverne, and Canby were owned by their cities, and when Sanford took over the local hospital, they wanted Sanford to take on the ambulance operations as well. They did not want to own or manage an ambulance service. Ambulance services in communities with local hospitals are a critical lifeline for rural citizens when their medical conditions require movement to a larger hospital able to provide definitive care. Having a robust ambulance capable of doing transfers is important to a local hospital and community. 2736 could gut our system and impact rural patients in a negative way. We believe in the virtues of the current primary service area structure. It guarantees ambulance coverage to the entire area that we serve, not just larger population centers. The changes proposed in the bill put rural Minnesota at risk of losing ambulance coverage. In our Moorhead PSA, there simply isn't enough ambulance call volume outside the cities of Moorhead and Dilworth to support the economics of an ambulance. We cover 6 cities and 23 townships and 770 square miles in the county. I don't see the logic of making it more onerous to serve rural Clay County, where we're already operating at a loss. The real issues are not PSA related. Ambulance services in Minnesota need action on workforce and reimbursement. Without a comprehensive plan to attract people to the profession, we will continue to struggle in Minnesota. I request you don't create more hardship for Minnesota ambulance services and ask you do not pass 2736 and focus on the real issues that plague our state and nation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Okay. We've got Buck McAlpin, and then Robert Benson, then Tim Malchow, then Deborah Calvert. Welcome.
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, Buck McAlpin at the Ambulance Association. I think I'll be the last one to testify from the Ambulance Association. We decided that
I think the comment's been made a lot. But I want to thank Chair Becker-Finn for bringing. These folks aren't here for this bill. They're here for my ambulance funding bills later tonight. So that's what they actually showed up for.
Oh, I'm glad we're here.
So I appreciate all your help, Madam Chair, helping with that. But just quickly, I really want to thank the fire chiefs. We've met almost weekly. We met probably the last 6 months with Chief Jungman and the chiefs. Absolutely, you heard from these folks. I visit with all of you all the time. COVID really did some funny things to the ambulance industry. And Mr. Ferguson from the Regulatory Board has the data. 60% of our emergency workers under 40 have left the field. And I see EMT Backer, who's been doing it a long time, and lots of us here with gray hair or not enough hair anymore. I've been in Brown EMS around 40 years, since 1982. And we need some real work to happen in some type of select committee, a work group. I actually thought today about like an EMS and fire caucus like we see federally, where lots of issues we have to work on. I talked to some fire chiefs about even rural fire services, everything we have to put attention to. And I think some of the testimony tonight is overwhelming EMS volume. We also talked today, we think even non-emergency medical transportation is a big part of this conversation. Most of the folks behind you will tell you that when we don't have access to that, they call the ambulance for transportation. And then to take somebody back to the nursing home, we take an ambulance out of service for an hour, and where Mr. Ryber's from Perman, we can't do services. So we're going to absolutely commit to work to be sure that some of the lots of the issues are addressed so we can continue to have a vibrant industry. So we appreciate it.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Robert Benson. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I was going to use my time today. First of all, I'm Robert Benson, Assistant Ambulance Director, Lake City Ambulance. I'm here today on behalf of the City of Lake City and the Lake City Ambulance Service. I was going to use my 2 minutes to talk about how I oppose this bill, but it seems like we're past that. So I'm going to use my time to plead with you for attention to EMS in general and funding. I want to look at solutions. In my opinion, I think we should fund the Minnesota EMSRB, give them our support, give them the staff needed to address these issues. Let the people that know EMS work on it. Give them what they need. Give them the tools. Give them the money. Healthcare in general is in a bad, bad spot. All of our baby boomers are retiring, which means they're leaving the workforce. They've gone from being a nurse to now being a patient. And our call volume is rising and rising, and our resources are being limited. We need funding. We can't pay an EMT $15 an hour when McDonald's will pay them $20. I just plead for your attention to this and funding and your help. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Tim Melchow, and then Deborah Calvert, then Brad Peterson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Melchow. I'm the EMS Chief for the City of Cannon Falls. We are against 2736 for many reasons. The current PSA law, every Minnesotan visitor has an access to an ambulance service. With proposed changes, many townships locally within Goodhue County will not have an ambulance service because the one that's serving them now will not apply for a permit to operate in those areas. Their main reason why that is because of funding. These townships currently, when they call 911, get an ambulance within 10 minutes. After this bill, if it would go through as written, if the other closest ambulance service is permitted, you'd see probably at least a 25-minute response time. Funding and recruitment is the main issues in EMS right now. With funding on decline, many ambulance services are operating at a break-even point or even operating in the red. The Republican Eagle reported on February 1st of 2022 that an ambulance service within our county operated their ambulance service at a $1.1 million loss while providing care in their PSA. This is not about ambulance monopolies in Minnesota, but funding and providing high-quality patient care and ensuring we can answer the call for every Minnesotan visitor. The performance standards within the bill should not be there. We need to have standards that are adopted that are based on patient care and help drive better patient outcomes. I want to ensure that the people of Minnesota and our visitors have an access to an ambulance when they have an emergency, and this bill would definitely jeopardize our ambulance response.
Thank you. Deborah Calvert, followed by Brad Peterson, followed by Chief Steve Coring. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I'm Deb Calvert, Minnetonka Council Member at Large from Minnetonka, member of the League of Minnesota Cities Improving Services Delivery Committee, and wife of a 40-year career firefighter, EMT, and emergency manager. I appreciate that this hearing was scheduled so that we may share some troubling trends happening in our communities, and I thank you for this opportunity to speak on a topic that is so important to me personally and to my community. I'm here with my mayor, Brad Wearsome, a recent past president of the League of Minnesota Cities, and our city manager, Mike Funk. I know from my committee work, there are EMS challenges across the state. We heard some of them tonight. And I am proud to be supporting the fire chiefs from Richfield, Hopkins, St. Louis Park, Eden Prairie, who have worked for 20 months with our provider to find mutually agreeable solutions. The 225 residents of these cities frequently experience ambulance response times that surpass industry standards. In some cases, patients have waited up to an hour and a half. In my own community of Minnetonka, we have tracked more than 300 medical calls during a 9-month period that resulted in ambulance response times of greater than 10 minutes. This is not acceptable. When this happens, our own fire and police personnel must remain on the scene with patients until the ambulances arrive. It places our entire community at greater risk. Calling 911 means you or a loved one are in crisis and need immediate attention. I can share numerous examples. Some include residents with a broken leg, another with chest pains, in which they waited more than an hour for an ambulance. In these examples, family members took matters into their own hands, loaded the person up, and drove them to the hospital themselves. As a council member, I'm here to fulfill my responsibility to keep Minnetonkans and thousands of other residents in our region safe. I would ask that you keep in mind the following. Our current system, as pointed out by the Office of the Legislative Auditor, is not working and needs to change.
And I do have to ask you to wrap up. Sorry.
Cities can determine which companies provide sanitary services and cable, but not ambulance services. Local governments are in the best position to determine what level of coverage they receive, and that includes the ability to monitor performance and work with providers to make improvements that will meet the needs of the community. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Brad Peterson, followed by Chief Steve Coring, followed by Tom Fletcher. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Bradley Peterson. I'm here today on behalf of the Coalition of Greater Minnesota Cities. In my 15 years of lobbying, this is the first time I have been in front of the Health and Human Services Committee. So please be gentle. And why am I here? I'm here because last week we received, in the span of a day, several calls from cities across the state who were panicked by the implications of this bill. It's clear that EMS service across the state is in a tremendously fragile condition. I think we all agree with that. The thing that got our people's attention about this particular approach in this bill was that it seemed tremendously disruptive to the current system, and it created a lot of uncertainty and anxiety when it came to how the needs of their communities would be met. Panic, I think, is the appropriate word. It also, from the perspective of our members, looked like, whether true or not, but it looked like we were trying to solve a metro area problem with a statewide solution. So I think there's a couple of things I want to close with. One is there's been some discussion about local control, and usually I am a great proponent of local control. But I think when our folks looked at this bill, they became somewhat daunted by the potential local responsibility. Many of our smaller cities are not set up to handle many of these issues. And so I urge you to keep that in mind as we go. I would also urge you that as you go forward, keep in mind the recruitment and retention questions that have been raised by many of the folks behind me. That is a critical issue in rural Minnesota. So, Madam Chair and Representative Becker-Finn, I appreciate the comments that you made at the beginning of the hearing, and I appreciate your cautious and thoughtful approach to trying to solve these problems. As you do so, I would urge you to definitely engage with local leaders in rural Minnesota to make sure that their concerns are accounted for. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Come back to the committee sometime.
I can't wait.
We don't fight. Chief Steve Coring, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, thank you for allowing us to have this conversation. It's been a long, long time, and I'm glad to do it tonight. I'm Steve Coring. I'm the fire chief for the city of St. Louis Park, and I am here to support House File 2736, and I'd like to share my reasons why. Like most cities, EMS response is a significant component of the services that we provide for our residents, so much, in fact, that we consider it a quality of life issue. And because of that, the community is sitting front and center of a significant challenge currently facing the system that delivers our EMS today about how it delivers responsive care. The current approach to delivering 911 response is no longer keeping pace with the growing demands of the population and the significant attrition of its workforce. Every day in the United States, 10,000 people turn 65 years of age, and that clock keeps ticking. And because of that, those aging demands are also creating amazing, huge demands in our 911 system, coupled with the downstream impacts to an already overflowing hospital emergency system. The reality is that for the significant number of these patients, transport by ambulance is not necessary. In fact, the greatest needs are for them to be connected to community-based resources that meet them right where they're at. There is no one more aware of what resources exist within the community than the community itself, and by understanding the social determinants that are community-specific, it is possible for a community to build a more responsive approach which would improve access, equity, and quality while providing a more cost-effective approach compared to an ambulance ride. As these challenges have continued to mount, we have tried for months to collaborate and partner with our license holder, only to be met with an unwillingness to explore options which would maximize the use of our combined resources while prioritizing ambulance service to those that need it the most. Local government should be at the table to decide how service is delivered. PSA license holders should be open to providing the most responsible level of care and not always just using an ambulance to solve the problem. As I stated, this is a quality of life issue within our communities, and we should have a voice. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Tom Fletcher? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. My name is Tom Fletcher. I'm a council member in the city of Greenwood, which is right by Excelsior, and also a member of the Excelsior Fire District Board, representing Greenwood. The world has changed greatly since the Minnesota's current EMS system was established, and I would advocate that we need to take a strong look at the system, such as this House File 2736 does. Two key questions that I would ask are, number one, would we structure the system as it is currently if we were starting from scratch today? And then secondly, does one solution fit all for Minnesota? Maybe what works for greater Minnesota doesn't work for Greenwood, which is a suburb of in the metro area. And that clearly has been raised by the comments from Minnesota Greater Metro Cities. I totally agree with the comments raised by the ambulance providers, specifically Susan Long. Reimbursement is a huge problem for this industry. I don't know that anybody has the solution. Hopefully they do, but it's a huge problem. There's a shortage of paramedics. We all know that. Paramedics presumably aren't paid enough to attract and keep people. That's a problem. You got this vice. Reimbursements are too tight, and you can't attract the people, and you can't keep them. On the other hand, fire departments have have changed over the years, and our calls have changed. 75% conservatively of fire calls are now medical calls. Fire calls themselves are very few. So fire departments are more medical departments than fire departments these days. And in addition, the training professionalism of firefighters has increased over the years. I would hypothesize a new system
one should be able to look at, you know, changing the roles and adjusting the roles, which local control gives you more ability to do when the circumstances fit. A prime example is Edina, where Mr. Shear was the fire chief and ran a combined fire ambulance service that delivered a response in typically 6 minutes, or average of 6 minutes. I would note that in Greenwood, I would be very happy to have the response at Cannon Falls site of less than 10 minutes through my doorstep, because our response right now for code 3, that's emergency calls, that's not code 2, is 12.79 or 12.53 minutes. That was the average response time. So our average response by our current provider, I bet. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. So that reaches, that is the end of the list that I had, and I just want to thank you all for your testimony. It is clearly, this is a really complicated issue and one that really does deserve a lot of attention on a lot of levels. And I would invite anyone who did not testify or who has more to say to please, you know, you can reach out to us by email, send us a letter, especially if you have, I would say, ideas about things we could do, as, and I did hear some good ones today, and you may have noticed I was taking notes the whole time. So we definitely are listening closely to what everyone has to say here. So we will turn now to member discussion. So Representative Becker.
Yes, Madam Chair and Chair Becker Finn. First of all, I do appreciate the comment of working on this. You know, where I'm very much interested in continuing to work on. You know, we heard that staffing and recruitment is something of an issue. Also, I think there's another issue that we need to talk about. Since I became an EMT almost 30 years ago, it's going to be 29 this year, we have really came from a emergency moving to a primary care to sometimes, as my fellow colleagues would agree, a taxi service, okay? And we don't, the council member from, is it Green? Greenwood, you know, sometimes these runs that we have are not emergency runs. It's one of the greatest challenges I have when my pager goes off Friday night or Saturday night when I'm back in the district. So we do have to start to address those issues. Mental health, in greater Minnesota, when there's a mental health issue, it's the deputies or it's EMTs. And with me being the senior member, it's mostly when is Jeff coming when I'm on call. So we have to also talk, and we've had those discussions, Chair, and I appreciate those discussions. So when we have slower response time, we have to look at what's tying up the rakes and so forth. So that primary care is something that we have to look at. One of the things I do, and I know I've been part of the industry for almost 29 years, so I may be biased, but one of the things when I got started in 97, 98, that time, Minnesota was recognized as one of the best EMS systems in the country, and we still are, and that's because of these fine ladies and gentlemen. We run to a problem. That's what we do. And as we heard, we want to run to this problem, Chair Becker Finn and Chair. So because the thing that I have greatest concern, and I know the PSA, we've had discussions, has hiccups. I get it. But one of the things I'm concerned about right now when we have emergency care and we have crap that hits the fan, we as EMS professionals complete each other. We don't compete. And that's a concern how this bill is written. I know we can make it better and look at how we can make improvements. We heard that. But there are times when I know as a volunteer, we had about 4 or 5 weeks ago, we had for the Graceville ambulance, which I don't serve on, had a 2-car accident with 5 individuals. Browns Valley got called out, which was me at 1:30. Ortonville got called out. Beardsley first responders come out. And in matter of within 10, 15 minutes, we had enough people to handle a lot more. And that's what these good folks do. And thank you. Thank you for doing that. And so forth. So I'm very much interested in helping, continuing to help with that, because I want us to continue to complete the great service that EMS has provided and is looked upon in the nation. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Becker. Representative Kwan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And my suggestion to the author
and the chair is that, well, right now we've got three members that have served on the EMSRB. We've got many members that have either been on or have family members that have been in. So we should have a working group because there are so many different variations and flavors of the care. Personally, in my area, there's a first responder group. There's the fire department, and then there's an ambulance service. The first responders go and give the initial care, and that pager goes off, and they're out the door before the 60-second clock is gone. And there are so many varieties of different things that you're responding to. Most of them are tough, but, boy, my wife had a smile when she delivered a baby. You know, so sometimes you have good things of, and when you save a life. So there's a lot of variation, and I don't think any one author can do this. So let's get a work group, because we do have a lot of knowledge here. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Quam. Representative Akam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I represent a community in the western suburbs, and people from my community and neighboring communities spoke tonight. And so what I really want to say is with concerns about the current situation and the need for reform, and I heard that from everybody, but I was especially tuned into those testifiers who were near my community of Minnetonka. And so I just wanted to thank the author of the bill for her opening statement to say that really this is the start of a conversation and that we need to work together toward a solution. And maybe that solution isn't going to be a one-size-fits-all, but what I appreciated was the nature that she is putting forth to take on this challenging topic. And so I just wanted to recognize that and appreciate that. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all for being here tonight. This is a complicated issue. The expectations are different from different communities, and I think you guys have all stepped up and have talked about that. I want to thank Representative Becker Finn for bringing this. We know for sure that one size doesn't fit all. I mean, the county that I'm in, and I was lucky enough to travel with the Hennepin Ambulance and EMS guys a few weeks ago, and I went into their dispatch center, and I'm watching this. And in my county, there's nine separate PSAPs, not including the EMS PSAP. And to watch, and to watch those units move around a board when those calls are coming in all the time, it is an amazing thing. And I recognize that that's not like your area, Representative Backer. And that's why I think that the one size fits all doesn't work. I think we have to build on those things that work in the regions that we're in. Incorporate the comments and recommendations from fire, from first responders, from EMS, from docs, and then build a system that's going to work for everyone in their individual areas. And I really appreciate the fact that you're taking this on. It's a complicated topic, and I will do anything I can to help. So thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you very much. So with that, Chair Becker Finn, would you like to say a few closing words?
Yeah, thank you, Chair Liebling. And I do want to thank everyone who's here who testified on either side of this particular bill. I think the important thing to me is that this is a systemic issue. It isn't, you know, if there are delays in times and response, that isn't necessarily the fault of any of these people who serve any of our communities. And that's really what we're looking at this from, is not kind of pinning it personally on any one entity or group or person, but saying this system isn't working. And so, much of the testimony wasn't actually about what's in this bill, but honestly, I'm happy for this to be the vessel for us to hear those voices and to hear those things. You know, recruitment, retention, all those things, the reimbursement rates. I know Representative Hewitt has like 17 bills after this. And so if this was a vehicle and this was a way to lift up those voices in this space, I think that's really important. Finally, I'll just say is that, when the system is not working for some communities, the answer of any one of us cannot be to say, well, it's working fine for me, so just leave it as it is. That cannot be the response when we have some communities who are really negatively impacted by this system. And so I just want us to be careful that we don't sort of throw out the whole idea because any one particular community might like the way it is. That's great if this is working well for you. It is not working for everybody in our state. And that really is why this needs to come forward and why I'm glad we have this platform. Some have dismissed this as a metro issue. I push back on that. But even if it was, why wouldn't we want people in every city, in every area, and even if you don't live in a city, why wouldn't we want every Minnesotan to receive the best care and be as safe and healthy as they can be and receive the service that they deserve? So I was happy to sit here and hear all the voices, and stay tuned, Representative Quam. I have no doubt that this conversation will continue after tonight.
All right. Thank you so much. I would like to add my thanks, Chair Becker-Finn, for bringing the bill, and to everybody, and not only for being here tonight, but for the work that all of you do. And I would really like to echo what Chair Becker-Finn says. You know, we very much appreciate the kind of quality of work that we have from the EMS community in this state. And despite the fact that we have a system that maybe isn't always functioning the best it could, we know we have people who are truly outstanding public servants, and so we really do appreciate that. And I would just add to what Chair Becker-Finn said, that it isn't working for everyone, and it absolutely must work for everyone in the state. That is our goal, right? We cannot have a state where everyone doesn't have a high level of ambulance service when they need it. That just seems like something that's very much our responsibility to help all of you achieve. And I know that is what all of you want to do and are doing. So thank you very much. So with that, House File 2736, as amended, is laid over. Okay, we will next take up.
They're not
going to
stick around?
House File. Okay, and folks, we are going to go right into our bills, so if you're going to leave, please try to be quiet so that we can keep on working here. Folks, please take your conversations outside, please. And we're going to first take up House File 621, Representative Hewitt, if that's okay with you. Is that okay? Because I understand we have testifiers, so we want to first take up the bills.
Whatever you want to do, Chair, that's fine with me.
Unless you have a different preference.
I have to look at which one it is.
That's what the staff is telling me, and I try to listen to the staff. So,
Chair, I'm going to, can I have a personal privilege for a minute?
Yes, you may, absolutely may, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. And committee members, you heard a very interesting bill tonight, and I got to thank Chair Becker-Finn for taking it, because I didn't want to take it because I was too close to the issue. You'll hear a lot of bills during the next 2 years that will surround this place and this space. We have a big lift here, and just be open. And I think that this legislature that's sitting today will be able to come forward with some good plans to move EMS in the future. So with that, I think I have my testifiers here somewhere, don't I?
All right. So the chair will move House File 621 to be laid over for possible inclusion. And let's see, is there anyone? Okay. So let's see, do I have that? Oh, yes. And so there is an A1 amendment. And did you want to move the A1 amendment?
Madam Chair, I do.
All right, so the chair will move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. Real quickly, this is the grant program that's administered by the MSRB to the 8 regions. Most of you that live in the state, there are 8 EMS regions that perform various tasks, and actually the amendment is one of the tasks that we would ask them to perform. This is Representative Baker's bill for our first responders to carry Narcan. This is exactly what one of the tasks. They complete so many tasks for us. They were really active during COVID, and we really need these grants to be in place. It's just a appropriation for this biennium. I believe my testifiers are here. I can't tell their story as well as them, and hopefully they're here.
All right. So we have Jill Roret. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Jill Roret. I am the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Emergency Services Board, which serves as the regional EMS board for the metro region. I am here representing the 8 EMS regions. Thank you for hearing House File 621, which is a request for additional funding for the EMS regions. For some perspective, in 1989, each EMS region annually received $115,000. In 2021, each EMS region received $73,500. The EMS region also receives an appropriation from seatbelt fine revenues, though that funding has been in decline as more people comply with the law, which I guess is a good problem to have. Frequently, EMS regions are told to budget using a specific target number, and over the last few years, we've received about half of that target number, which makes it difficult to plan programming for our paramedics and emergency medical technicians. In 2021, the legislature appropriated $800,000 per year for 2 years for the regional EMS programs. This resulted in each of the 8 EMS regions in fiscal years 2022 and 2023 receiving $95,000 per year. House File 621 continues to increase that funding and would put it in the base budget so EMS regions can plan their programming accordingly. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. And then Jim Reber.
Double duty.
Yes. Welcome, and please reintroduce yourself for the record.
Thank you. Again, my name is Jim Reber. I'm the Director of EMS for Perm EMS and the Emerging Manager for Perm Health, and I'm also the Board Chair for West Central Region EMS. West Central, Greater Northwest, and Southwest have a coalition that we do a lot of programs working together to provide services for the rural services we have. EMS regions have 7 statutory obligations to perform that each region meets those in different ways. We do every year or 2 years for part of the grant, we do a study of our area, a needs assessment of our area to look at what our partners in EMS need that we can help them provide. Most of the focus in the rural areas that we provide are working with programs, EMS, the ambulance services, the first responders, the law enforcement agencies in the rural areas, to help them and support them with education, training, equipment, and communication grants. We do matching funds for equipment purchases. We do grants for education for them to get training for their staff. We do grants to help them go to EMS conferences, like Arrowhead has a massive conference every year for training for EMS to keep them up to speed. The regional programs support that, and without the support that they provide, a lot of these services wouldn't be able to have quality professional EMS training. The regions work together on statewide plans, teams, events. During some of the earlier disaster planning, there were strike teams that were put together. The regional programs are the core essence of working within their region. They know all the people. They know all of the services, what capability they have, and they're the core unit that comes together to support all of the EMS systems everywhere from, again, it's not just ambulance, it's the first responders, it's the rescue squads, the fire departments, the law enforcement agencies that are out there. The EMS supports critical incident stress debriefing teams out in the rural areas. Without the support from some of the grant money from the regional programs, most of the rural areas wouldn't be able to have a critical incident stress team to respond and help when they have traumatic or tragic responses that staff need help dealing with. Regional program suffered a loss of funding when seatbelt fine decreases. Again, as Jill had said, that's a good thing because the compliance is up, but the revenue is down, and that cuts into the amount of work we can do with providing grants and partnerships with the agencies in our regions. We are the collaboration agency for all of the different EMS agencies in our area, in our region, and we have a quarterly meeting with all of the law enforcement sheriffs, all of the rescue squad chiefs, things like that, to help build collaboration between all the teams and all the groups. Many programs, without the support that the regional programs provide to these to the rescue squads, many of the programs would not be able to maintain the quality of equipment they have, the quality of service they provide. And I'll reference to Representative Backers. They have to do their pancake feed every year to have enough money to be able to respond on call to serve the people. We're able to help support that, and without this additional funding, it's going to dramatically limit what we can do to help support the first responders that are out there every day. Thank you for your time.
All right. Well, thank you for your testimony. So is there anyone else in the audience who wanted to testify on this bill? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone. So is there any member discussion? All right. Final word, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a great bill. The seatbelt fines have pretty much disappeared, and so we need to find another mechanism. Again, the theme of tonight is EMS funding. So.
All right, thank you. So House File 621, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. Let's take up House File 449 next, if that's okay, because we're just taking up the ones first that had people signed up. So we're trying to let your testifiers go home if they so choose after they testify.
Oh, they are so into this, Madam Chair.
All right, so House File 449. So the chair will move that House File 449 be laid over for possible inclusion, and the chair will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the form in which the author would like to present it. And that looks like just a technical amendment. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, it is.
All right, so all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So, Representative Hewitt, to your bill as amended.
Madam Chair and members, this really quickly is a bill that it does something new this time that we didn't put in it last year. This money used to be appropriated by the Department of Public Safety. However, the appropriation cut off without notice, and it left these two communication centers without funding at all, and thanks to the both of them, they kept going. What this is about, though, it's a East Metro and West Metro Control, that's what I refer to them as. This is a big resource for us around the state. This is a place you can call into when you need a medical director or when you need a doc. They can give you orders right there. They can talk to you about your patient. You can tell them where you're going. They're going to be able to direct you. They're going to tell you if that hospital, well, we don't yet have divert anymore, but they used to be able to tell us if people are on divert. It's the brainchild of the EMS system when we're on the street. Today I have Matt Wilder with me, and Madam Chair, if he could testify for this, that'd be great.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Matt Milder. I'm the Director of Emergency Medical Services for Regents Hospital and also oversee the East MRCC, or Medical Resource Control Center. Thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony on this funding bill to support a vital part of the state's emergency medical response infrastructure. Medical Resource Control Centers, or MRCCs, are a statewide resource to provide ambulance to hospital communications vital to the provision of quality emergency care. The MRCCs act as the ambulance flight control center for local, regional, and state EMS agencies by coordinating patient care and transportation for ground and air operations. The MRCCs are integrated in the state's allied radio matrix for emergency response, or the ARMR system, and are the point of contact for statewide public safety entities, hospitals, and for each region's community as an informational resource. The West MRCC is located and operated by Hennepin Health, and the East is operated by Regents Hospital based here in St. Paul. Hennepin and Regents are also the state's largest safety net hospitals and providers of charity care. Since 2005, the state had helped fund the MRCCs through a grant appropriation of $683,000 split annually between the two centers. As you can see in the MRCC handout on the back in your packets, call volumes and operating costs for the centers have increased significantly over the past decade, and while state support remains static until the special session of 2021 when the grant program was eliminated. The MRCCs have continued to operate with no state support since June of 2022, when the last state-funded MRCC grants were exhausted. We are here seeking to restore state funding at a more sustainable level for these critical emergency response assets that benefit the entire state but are not currently funded but are currently funded by Minnesota's largest safety net hospitals alone. We are proud to host these life-saving assets at our respective hospitals, and even if the bill is passed, we will continue to subsidize their operation because it falls within our missions to improve health and well-being in partnership with our communities and to ensure access to outstanding care for everyone. But we cannot do so without your sustainability and support. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. John Hick.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the time and for the opportunity and for your service. My name is John Hick. I'm an emergency physician at Hennepin Healthcare, Deputy EMS Medical Director there. I've also had the privilege, perhaps dubiously sometimes, of a variety of state and federal leadership roles, including being the incident manager for the statewide healthcare coordination center during the early phase of the COVID pandemic. 35 years ago, which seems hard to believe, when I was an EMT in Northfield, I called MRCC when I was bringing patients into the metro. Today, mainly MRCC calls me. It might be because we've got a hospital on diversion because of infrastructure issues that wants to stay on divert. It might be because we need a physician response to a scene. Maybe it's 20 children on a school bus with minor damage that need medical clearance instead of transportation to the hospital. It can be a variety of things, but we try to coordinate 34 hospitals and 24 EMS transport agencies. MRCC provides the umbrella that maintains the communication and keeps coordination, particularly when we have larger incidents. Generally speaking, MRCC is the Swiss Army knife of coordination. If we need blood at a rescue scene, MRCC is the one we call. When we have a child endangerment situation that EMS and hospitals need to be aware of immediately, we call MRCC. But it's really in events that cross jurisdictional lines or involve multiple agencies where MRCC is particularly needed to coordinate radio traffic, to coordinate patient distribution amongst our multiple hospitals and trauma centers, to track those patients. So within hours after the bridge collapse, for example, in 2007, we had a list of patients at their hospitals and were able to start that family reunification process quickly. We also, hopefully, we'll never have to, but we have a plan to activate chemical antidotes for a large-scale nerve attack. Those are just some of the responsibilities that MRCC has on a daily basis. I want to call out their role during the civil unrest. They were instrumental in making sure that ambulances could make it safely to hospitals during rapidly evolving situations in which safe routes were not necessarily guaranteed. There is no entity that otherwise provides these coordination mechanisms, nor capable of providing those mechanisms. This is necessary 24/7, 365. I've been privileged to look very hard at events like Las Vegas and the Harvest shooting. Jurisdictions that do not have these entities suffer chaos and likely loss of life because they can't coordinate their systems effectively. This is going to be a focus of federal, not only programmatic, but also potentially funding and regulation over the coming years as I work to author the Hospital Preparedness Program guidance for the 2023 to 2028 HHS cycle. This is a core component. Minnesota has been ahead of the curve in having one of these medical operations coordination centers, what we refer to as MRCCs, already in place. It would be a shame to lose any of that functionality now. Thank you so much for your consideration. Ms. Chair, we'd be happy to take any questions you might have or provide follow-up information.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your testimony. So, first of all, is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on this bill? Okay. We'll go to members then. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate that. Representative Hewitt, and maybe your testifier can also explain. I come from the rural area. So when we're looking at the response within the metro area and this facility, I believe we have armor systems all over. So how is this part of that, or is it just one of the many systems?
I would refer to Dr. Hick.
Okay, Dr. Hick.
Madam Chair and Representative, thank you so much for the question. So, because the bulk of the hospital inpatient resources are located in the metro area, even when an incident occurs in the outstate, MRCC can play a critical role in making sure that we have the transport assets and also we know the capacity of the hospitals to receive those patients. In some situations also, a facility in Greater Minnesota might need to evacuate because of flooding. For example, during the Red River floods, MRCC was extremely helpful in helping find hospital beds and coordinating information as those facilities evacuated patients, both long-term care as well as hospital, into the metropolitan area.
Representative Keel, follow-up?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. And I just make a comment about, I remember the helicopters moving. It was an interesting life at that point, but them moving senior citizens at nursing homes and just in general, something I don't want to relive again. But it was very efficient and really helped people to be safe and cared for long-term, because, of course, people couldn't come back into their facilities within days. It was sometimes 2-3 weeks just to find a place to live. So, but I appreciate the system and just wanted to know if it all, so it works entirely the whole state. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I'd like to understand, since there's quite a few resources in a location like Rochester with Mayo, and they've got their helicopters, they've got the ambulance and et cetera. So you're coordinating everything up here and nothing is being done locally there, even if they have a great deal of resources?
Dr. Dick.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's an excellent question. So the locations that have a single tertiary care center, for example, Mayo and CentraCare, Duluth is a little more complicated with two different, you know, trauma centers in close proximity. But the main issue that we face is when we're trying to coordinate multiple responding EMS agencies and taking patients to multiple different hospitals, especially when there is a choice of specialty centers. And that's why MRCC primarily focuses its efforts on the metro areas, because that coordination nexus is so important to maintain coordination, both communication and patient distribution and response-wise, amongst all of the agencies that serve that this geographic area. It's not to say that there's not important aspects of planning that go into disaster planning in each of those regions. And the healthcare coalitions are Minnesota Department of Health sponsored coalitions that integrate EMS, hospitals, emergency management, and public health, do a great job within their area of making sure that they have clear communication streams and mechanisms. But fortunately, in Rochester, because Gold Cross and Mayo Transport, sorry, I used to work for Gold Cross, forced to have it, Mayo Med Transport is the primary service provider, it's much easier for them to coordinate communications and response as a single ALS provider serving that area, for example.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I'm trying to understand is regionally, you know, you've got Mankato, you've got other regional centers. And at some point, has there been the thought of having regional coordination as opposed to the metro driving?
Madam Chair, Representative Quam, you just we just passed a bill earlier for the regions, and the regions also have mobile trailers that if we have a disaster, I think you had a bus disaster in your area in the last several years. During that disaster, a trailer like that would be activated. It would have radios. They would set up a mini medical control center to make sure that hospitals could handle. So outstate, that's kind of, we have a backup plan for that. But in the metro, and again, in his in their situation here in the metro, I come from the flight world. We use those MRC, the medical control centers, all the time in the flight world. They're telling us where to go to the hospital. We usually have to talk to a doc. And even any ambulance throughout the state could call into the center if they need a doc. So I hope that it is regional, even though it focuses on metro because that's where our biggest population is. But, it, you know, and then for outstate, like you were talking about, we do have plans for that.
Yeah. Representative Quam, follow-up?
Just that it'd be nice to have that more structured to understand those divisions. And yes, we have at least annual drills with those mobile centers, and I've gone to some of those to see. But, yeah, I think offline I will try to have a better understanding, because, you know, oftentimes there's a lag, and I think a regional approach might be good, but thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Crawman. I have a question as well. Dr. Hick, could you just give us a little bit of a picture of, you know, what goes on in the center? How many people are working there? Is it, if I was to go visit, would it look like, a 911 call center? What are we talking about here physically?
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the way that East Metro and West Metro handle MRCC is very slightly different. I'll describe West Metro, and if Matt has other comments, he can jump in. On the West Metro side, we have one dispatch position that is dedicated to MRCC. So essentially, they are responsible for handling all the calls coming in from ambulances with patients destined for different hospitals, messaging those hospitals, tracking information on, say, an ambulance that's requesting a physician to the scene, getting those pages out. We can spill over those responsibilities to our other operators within our dispatch center if needed, and if we need to during an event, we will bring in an additional dispatch position just to support MRCC. So I would think of it as a person that is primarily fulfilling those responsibilities in the context of our dispatch center, with the ability to, you know, spread those responsibilities as needed during an event.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions from members? Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just curious on, like, what percentage of the calls would be outstate versus metro?
Dr. Hill.
Madam Chair and Representative, that's an excellent question. I would have to get back to you on that. It is a smaller percentage by far, and we understand that the daily benefit to the outstate absent and incident may not be significant, but in the case of any mass casualty incident occurring anywhere except where there is a large tertiary care center, and even then, in cases of a large burn incident or an incident that, you know, revolves around specific capability needs like pediatrics that we don't have a lot of capacity in the state for, those patients are going to wind up coming into the metro, and MRCC assists, with those efforts. I think to the other point that was made about the Red River flooding, anytime we would have a hospital that loses infrastructure from a tornado or flooding or other things, there often is a magnetic pull to have those patients come into the metro, and because most of the inpatient beds in the state are there, that usually is where those patients will wind up getting transferred, and MRCC becomes, again, the broker for those, you know, requests and processing.
Representative Murphy?
Yeah, I would like to see those numbers just to give us, you know, a rough idea of here what, you know, what it looks like. So thank you.
And finally, Representative Backer.
Yeah, just really actually, Madam Chair, it is safe to say, and I've seldom been involved with it because I don't get involved with calling the helicopters, but these two, Hennepin and East and West, whichever it is, they handle all the helicopter traffic to all the hospitals in greater Minnesota. Is that a correct statement?
Dr. Hick.
Or most of it?
Madam Chair and committee members, the majority of it is handled through there, yes. And we are always the backstop whenever cellular or other communications are not available, which, you know, does happen. But the flight crews definitely rely on MRCC also for safety information. Again, I'll just jump back to the civil unrest issues. When we had safety issues, temporary flight restrictions, other things in place, MRCC is the information gateway to understand where helicopters may safely approach hospitals.
Just a final comment.
All right. Representative Beck.
Yeah, because especially as you get farther east in the state, you have a lot of the helicopter traffic come down to regions in Hennepin. Out where I'm at, we do go up to Stamford up in Fargo, but you do have a lot of traffic. If it's a burn, everybody's coming down to regions mostly. So thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Final word, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank to the testifiers tonight. This is a pretty important bill because even though we have a disruptive EMS system at this time, these centers are going to be the place that we keep our EMS in connection with medical directors. We're already starting to see in this committee telemedicine with EMS. This is probably going to be the parking spot for that, and it's so important that we keep them intact at this point. So as we move EMS to the next step of the doctor just said, we can discharge people from a scene, but they need to have the right information, and telemedicine seems to be that parking spot. So with that, I would thank you, Madam Chair, and please consider the bill.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Thank you, Dr. Thank Hick, and thank you to the other testifier as well. So House file, that was 449 as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. So let's go back and take up House file 141, if that's okay with you, Representative Hewitt. That was actually going to be the first one. And I don't think there's an amendment on that one.
Madam Chair, there is.
And so the chair will move that House file 141 be laid over for possible inclusion. And Representative Hewitt, to your bill.
Madam Chair, there is an A1 on
oh,
the 141.
There is one, huh? Mm-hmm. Oh, I don't think we don't have it. We do not have an amendment for that one. But
well, let's lay it over the way it is then.
Yeah, if you if you come up with one, you know, let us know, of course. And
it's on my paperwork. I don't Okay.
Well, is it just technical, or is it something that you have that is?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Buck McAlpin at the Ambulance Association. This is one Ms. Clevquist sent down, and it was more of a technical amendment about how the money's appropriated to the volunteers.
Okay. Well, that'll catch up with us. I think we just, you know, but as you can see, this was a lot of work for staff, a lot of bills to assemble. So, if we have only one mistake, that would be simply amazing, honestly. So, okay, but anyway, if you want to proceed, and you could even talk about that if you wish. And
right, Madam Chair, again, thank you for moving the bill, and Ms. Clarkus did get this to me, but I would bet it was my fault because I have six bills tonight, so sorry. But anyways, this bill before you today is another tool in the toolbox to assist recruitment and retention of emergency medical technicians. This bill would move the current reimbursement for an initial EMT course from $600 to $900, in continuation with the education from $275 to $375. This would reflect the increased cost of training in the last few years. Currently, this program is funded through the Minnesota Emergency Medical Regulatory Board. The legislator currently appropriates $361,000 of this a year in a training program. At times, all the funds are not expanded from the fund. With me today is Mr. McAlpine from the Minnesota Ambulance Association. And I would like you to call on him, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair, Committee, Buck McAlpin at the Ambulance Association. We've worked on this a few years as part of our other bills we brought forward this year that Chair Pawlowski's have heard and the K through 12 committee, Representative Hewitt's had. We've asked for some high school education money to train paramedics across the state for $3.5 million that's been heard in the House and Senate too. And this is the tool for the emergency medical technician piece. Paramedics are a couple years of education. Our emergency medical technicians are about 120. And every biennium lately, this pot of money hasn't been spent. So Mr. Ferguson from the Regulatory Board may have a small fiscal note on it. But what we're really trying to do with this is not have the unused money not get spent and just increase the reimbursement for the initial emergency medical technician classes and the refresher.
Okay, is there anyone else who would like to testify on the bill? All right, not seeing anyone. Member discussion. Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I think this is an excellent idea. I don't think we have to sell you on it, Representative Hewitt. But I would refer to a Farm Bureau program that my husband and I attended long time ago. Our now 45-year-old son was about three, and we brought him with. And what we learned was how to transport somebody in rural Minnesota if there was an accident, like getting your arm stuck in an auger, which does happen. And instead of trying to take the arm out of the auger, because we have the equipment usually in the field, we could cut off the auger and put the person, or hopefully the ambulance has shown up by then, but if they haven't, we transport them in our vehicle and take them to the hospital, and what not to do when you put somebody in a pickup or whatever to transport them. But it was very helpful because the reality is, I know we heard somebody from Metro that they had to wait, you know, maybe even an hour for an ambulance to come, and that's just not even, that's just a possibility in my world. So, in fact, we've transported people that are having heart attacks to the hospital to get stabilized because we can get there faster than the ambulance can get to us. And of course, there's risk involved in that. But I think this is a wonderful way to teach our young people in, you know, junior, senior years to be able to learn how to handle those emergencies or even how to respond to an accident before, you know, as you're calling the ambulance. And I wish it were a mandatory thing, but I don't think we want to make schools do more than they already have to do. But I really think it is just really important. In fact, I have a young constituent. Well, she's a little older now, but unfortunately the college students removed her from a car because they thought there was gas smell. And as EMTs were coming, they removed her and unfortunately not stabilized. And she is a quadriplegic now because she was moved. She's embraced the life that she's been, has led and does very well at it. But the unfortunate part is, had they not moved her, you know, maybe not. But I just think it's just a wonderful way to teach people and build our system, because obviously all of Minnesota is struggling with getting enough EMTs. I guess Representative Backer wants to retire at some point.
No, he hasn't said that.
No, he hasn't. You're right. He has not said that. But I know that my EMTs up in my neck of the woods are really struggling, and we just really need to do something. So thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Keel. So Mr. Harney has some information for us.
Chair Liebling, the testifier mentioned the possibility of fiscal note. I'm just confirming for the committee that pursuant to the completed fiscal note that the increase in reimbursement can be absorbed with existing appropriation levels.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Harney. And Mr. McAlpin, could you just explain the numbers in the bill? Like, you know, what is the number? Is this linked to the cost of the course, or just explain how that number was, both those numbers came about?
Yeah, Madam Chair, members, is usually in Minnesota, most of our emergency medical technician programs are offered by the Minnesota State College systems like Ridgewater. You also see the large healthcare systems like Hennepin County Medical Center or North Memorial or the Mayo Clinic and their education facilities. So some of these classes we see at the Minnesota West type programs are around $1,000 to $1,200 for the initial program, and then the refreshers 48 hours, and that's that lower fee of $375. So we kind of looked at what was left over every couple of years roughly and tried to say how could we add some more money to the pot with inflation to get closer to the actual cost of the class and limit some of the expenses on the ambulance services.
Okay, that was my other question. So the rest of the cost then is paid by the ambulance service, or not
Madam
by
Chair,
the student, though?
No, Madam Chair, usually by the ambulance service will cover
okay.
that.
Okay, great. All right. All right, thank you. Any other questions from the committee? All right, seeing none, final word, Representative Hewitt?
It's a great bill. It gets us somewhere.
All right, thank you very much. So House File 141 is laid over for possible inclusion. Let's take up House File 196. And so I will move that House File 196 be laid over for possible inclusion. And I understand there is an amendment on this one. And if there's an A1 amendment, and did you want to move that right away, Representative Hewitt?
Madam Chair, I do.
All right, so I will move the A1 amendment. And do you want to say anything about it before we adopt it?
No, I believe we'll hit that when we introduce the bill.
Okay. So all in favor of adoption of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is a favorite of Representative Keel. This is definitely an area that we need to focus on. Also, this is our NEEMT. These are the wheelchair people that we call in the field. This basically adjusts the per mile rate by 1%. Up or down for every increase or decrease of 10 cents for the price of gasoline. This rate change would trigger when the price of gasoline exceeds $3 a gallon. both any EMT and ambulance service providers would receive the fuel adjustment payment. Managed care and county-based purchasing plans would be required to provide full fuel adjustments for any EMT payment rates when the price of gasoline exceeds $3 a gallon. Fuel has been one of the largest costs of inflation for providers in this cost shift. Any help that would be funding for this would be a great relief to them. And again, I have Mr. McAlpine from the Ambulance Association to dig into the bill with us.
All right. Thank you, Mr. McAlpine.
Yeah, but Madam Chair, members, we've worked on this with DHS, and there is some language in the governor's budget for just non-emergency. Last year we had it for both non-emergency and ambulance. In one of the Senate bills, they added ambulance and non-emergency in there again in an earlier bill. And we're just looking for a reason. I think that the Department of Human Services will tell you, without legislative authority, they couldn't do anything with the rates. Managed care was able to do a little bit for some of the rates on the base rates to help providers during some COVID times, and just that's about 90% of their payer mix is Medicaid, especially for the non-emergency folks. So it was quite a financial impact. And they do a lot of deadhead miles. They only get paid like the ambulance one way when a patient is in either the wheelchair, van, and or the ambulance. So we've been working with DHS on this language, and I believe the amendment, Representative Hewitt, is a technical fix that DHS adds to this language. And we'd appreciate your support to just allow the Department of Human Services to be able to adjust this if fuel goes back to $4.50 or $5 a gallon or above the $3 number.
All right, thank you. Is there anyone who wants to testify on the bill? Okay, not seeing anyone. Questions? Representative Keel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll try not to talk on the next one. But as Representative Hewitt said, this has just been a real sore spot in rural Minnesota. But it is all of Minnesota that has this problem. It is really fine to transport somebody if you can get them in and out of a vehicle, but in a lot of places you can't. And I think about people that have to come from Roseau to do dialysis 2-3 times a week that are in a wheelchair, that those things happen, or chemo or something like that. That is a 2.5-hour drive one way to get that treatment, and there is nothing closer. I even had talked to one of my physicians to say, gee, can we get another dialysis area? But that is just too difficult. So this service that our people provide is super important. They're having a hard time getting drivers, but their insurance costs have gone up, and of course fuel costs have gone up, so they really are hanging by a thread. So it is something that we really, really need to do this year so that we can have sustainability. And once again, I would remind everyone, this is the whole state, whether it's metro or rural Minnesota. It's super important. So, yes. And I will sign under this bill. I was looking for it. So,
all right. Thank you, Representative Keel. Any other comments from members? And Mr. Harney, I assume we're waiting on a fiscal note on this.
Correct, Madam Chair.
Representative Nadeau.
I just have one question, and I just listened to Representative Keel, and she said that it applies to the state as a whole, and I'm looking on line 6.23, and it looks like it's only for outside metropolitan counties, and I don't think I care, but I'm just curious, does this apply only to outstate Minnesota, Mr. McAlpine?
Mr. McAlpin.
Madam Chair and Representative Nadeau, I believe it does because of the long distance of travel.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. All right. Thanks for clearing that up. Okay. Any other discussion to this bill? Final word, Representative Hewitt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for the consideration. And I believe one covers Metro that Representative Knorr is bringing forward. So I hope you're still willing to sign on to the bill, Representative Keel. Thank you, Madam Chair, for the consideration.
All right. And with that, House File 196, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. All right. And let's take up House File 643. And this is the last one. How is that possible? It's only 7:45. All right.
Did you want us to talk longer?
So I will. I will. Okay. So the chair will move House File 643 to be laid over for possible inclusion, and we do have an A1 amendment on this one. And did you want to add that right now, Representative Hewitt?
Madam Chair, I would like to move that right now.
All right. So I will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the order in which the author would like to discuss it. All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. The A1 is adopted. To your bill as amended.
Madam Chair and members, thank you. This is our last bill. Amen. Establishes this 643 actually is an interesting bill. This is a method of payment that we're looking at. It establishes a supplemental payment program to include all ambulance services licensed under 144E. The program would allow the state to assist a fee on ambulance services, which would be used to increase the medical assistance fund from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. The fund collected by the state from both ambulance providers and DHS would be paid back to the ambulance service as a supplemental payment. This amendment, the amendment would direct the Department of Health and Human Services to develop a process to implement and direct the payments of Medicaid for governmental ambulance service. And again, last night, the last of the bills here, Mr. McAlpine will explain the bill if you need more information.
All right. Thank you, Representative Hewitt. And this one does need some explaining. So welcome again, Mr. McAlpine.
Well, Madam Chair, members, I'll ask some indulgence because I'm not a Medicaid expert as much as I try to be, but I would also ask that if this bill would get laid over, as having very good conversations with the Department of Human Services, and I think as you all heard tonight, our association with the fire chiefs and our EMS-based services, you know, in Minnesota, I use the rule of eights at 80% of EMS, which the OLA audit had amazing data, but 77% totally is by the eight large healthcare systems. Another 10% of the volume is the St. Paul fires, Cloquet fires, Virginia fires, our other fire-based systems in the state. And then 10% are the two or three small privates that are left and all of our Browns Valley ambulances and small ones outside. In Minnesota years ago, with former lobbyist David Godfrey, that's no longer with us, him and I worked on the first supplemental payment for Hennepin County Ambulance and St. Paul Fire. And it was one of the first in the country to leverage a federal match for fee-for-service, Medicaid only. And out of 108 governmental ambulances today, about 85 or 90 of them participate that. Some of them draw in a couple $1 million. Some small ambulances, like the Cottonwood ambulance, draw in about $25,000. But that allows them to buy a defibrillator or equipment like that. So we've worked with the Ambulance Association over the summer and said, let's work on a supplemental payment. And in conversations with DHS, we talked about other ways to leverage in more federal money to help either with rates or some type of supplemental program. So about 12 states have implemented this for non-governmental ambulances. I'll talk first about the non-governmental, Madam Chair. And what this bill does is it allows us to put a 6%, basically a fee, like a supplemental fee onto the ambulance service that would be paid quarterly into DHS. And let's say that's $100 we collect, then they would send that back and get another $100 from the federal government, and we would bring that back and work with DHS and the Ambulance Association. We've been working with a consulting group called Sellers-Dorsey on this, and that fee and that money would go back into the Medicaid rates to pay provider, not Medicaid rates, but you'd get a supplemental payment quarterly based off your Medicaid mix. And especially when we get into rural Minnesota, most of our ambulance providers have 70-80% Medicare and Medicaid mixes, so it's quite high. Once that assessment's established, obviously this program also needs federal approval and what we do with it. We have talked with DHS if there's a different way. We were emailing at 5:30 this morning back and forth, so I know that group's up working early. And
they're working late. They're in the back.
Yep. And they said, let's continue to talk of different ideas that we make this program work. We think off rough estimates looking at data that for the non-governmental side, This would leverage in about $22 million a year of additional money to be distributed to ambulances in the state. So we're just trying to look for some ideas to leverage in. And like I said, 12 other states have implemented this for ambulance, and there's 20 other states right now that are working on it. Wisconsin did this last year and put it into play. We did some work with that one over there. And then the second piece, that was the smaller paragraph of language that we worked with Mr. Chung on, is the voluntary ambulance service payment under managed care is obviously a big part of our 85-90% of our Medicaid population now is under managed care. I know there's lots of conversations about what that looks like, but in the current format, this would ask the Department of Human Services to look at a way that we could do Medicaid-directed payments and put a program together with the other governmental ambulance services, which were many of our fire-based friends sitting behind us tonight, and how we could bring in more money like that. Madam Chair, as we talked about in your office, it's somewhat like the Hennepin County model and what they're doing, but as we've talked to DHS, we tried to say, not the Hennepin County model, but let's simplify a model that could be utilized to leverage in federal money for them. Rough estimates like this are probably more over $30 million, we think, because there's so much population and managed care that we could leverage in for ambulance services. So still work to do around this bill, and the Department of Human Services asked today, and I said I would tell all you that we want to continue to work on them as you put your bill together to try to make sure, most importantly, it's something they can implement. It's not cumbersome to providers, as we heard earlier. We can't expect the Caledonia Ambulance Rep Schumacher to work on putting together something like this. It has to be something pretty easy for them as we try to do something with Medicaid rates to help in the country. And I will say today, because of this legislature, Minnesota has the highest Medicaid rates in the country for ambulance operations. Our neighbors are at a third of what we are for Medicaid rates, and there was just an increase of 8.7% with the federal match, or the federal CPI increase, because our state statute says that our Medicaid rates climb with our Medicare rates. So that was something that also happened this year too. But still, it's about half of what the cost is to do an ambulance transport in the state for a 911 call or an interfacility transport.
So, Mr. McAlpin, I'm going to go to members, but just to clarify, is this voluntary for the ambulance service, or does everybody have to participate?
Madam Chair, on the supplemental one for the non-governmentals, it would be a mandatory fee. So our association has been out working with them now on contracts, because I thought, you know, as we work on legislation like this, I have to be sure that Alina Ambulance, Bemidji Ambulance, we have almost 80% of those ambulance services have signed the agreements to participate in the program.
Okay. I should ask, too, before we go any further, is there anyone who wants to testify on this bill? I take it the interest in this bill is high. That's why we've got so many folks here still. Anyone want to testify on it? Okay. All right. We'll go to member discussion then. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I hate to be first on this one, but I have, you know, this kind of reminds me of the old disproportionate share drawdowns, and which is super confusing, number one. And I don't know if I'm opposed to it, but I'm very fearful that we're taking public money to draw down, you know, we're using public money to pay an additional fee to draw down additional money, and then it gets transferred from areas of high concentrations to area of low concentrations. And I'm not sure that I'm opposed to that, but I don't understand the process. And it's very convoluted. So my biggest concern is that we're going to take money out of the metro, and you know, and that's fine. We can use it in Greater Minnesota if that's what's necessary. But tell me how that works, if you could.
Yeah, Mr. sure, Madam Chair, Representative Nadeau, the best I can is, actually, it's based off your Medicaid mix. And your comment about the governmental funding, that's an important comment. Our governmental ambulance services are allowed to use governmental money to leverage federal money because they're governmental entities. Our not-for-profits or privates are not allowed to utilize government money. So that's why we have the two different versions of this, because the non-governmental one allows us to leverage a supplemental payment up to 6% we can leverage. And part of what this bill does is it would, right now we pay the Minnesota Care Tax on services that are not volunteer, and it would take that tax and repeal it and allow us to leverage up to the 6%. So let's say North Memorial Ambulance, for instance, is a non-governmental. They would have the fee assessed on their net revenue, and then they pay that fee out of their proceeds. Now, the proceeds come from all ambulance operations, but whether it's a commercial payer or a Medicaid payer, and that's how they would be able to do it. Where I believe the governmental services, even in the healthcare side, can just use governmental money to leverage federal money. So as we look at the formula across the state based off the Medicaid pool and where the population is for Medicaid, based off your volume of Medicaid would be how much you received in a supplemental payment.
Representative Nadeau.
Clear as mud.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. So as this goes forward, are we going to get? Let me ask a question first. So let's just say hypothetically that North, we'll use North for example, they contribute $5 million in this new 6%. How, and it's going to come back, and it's going to come back as $10 million, right? We're going to basically double that money, Madam Chair?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and
Representative Mr. McAlpin.
The dough for the supplemental payments for the non-governmentals, it wouldn't be a dollar-for-dollar match. It would be that is, if the quarterly assessment statewide was $12 million, our goal would be to bring in $12 million federally to make that pot 24. So 12 from the federal, 12 from the supplemental payment, and then the 24 would go out based off your payer mix.
Representative Nadeau.
Okay, using that analogy, so from North, that service area generates $5 million. Do they get $10 million back in my example? Or, as you said, the distribution is based on the payer or the MA mix. I can't imagine, I mean, the numbers in Greater Minnesota, the percentages of MA population could be higher, but the actual N values in the urban area is so much greater. So will that be worked on as this goes forward? I'm not going to belabor this. Will we work on that?
Mr. McAlpin, everybody.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nadeau, yes, that's what we're talking with DHS about.
All right. Yeah. Thank you, sir. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, thank you. And you know, I know that technical assistance has been offered by DHS. I know that it isn't incorporated all here yet, and I'm hearing that discussions are continuing. So I appreciate your comment, clear as mud, because I was thinking the same thing. And it's not because Mr. McAlpin isn't good at explaining it. It's because this is a really inherently complicated thing, and kind of like what you referenced, disproportionate share, or what we're doing with Hennepin Health, or, you know, I've seen this before with years ago with a nursing home fee. I think when I was first elected, there was an extra fee put on nursing homes, and somehow that was massaged and came back as extra money for nursing homes. So it isn't, it's a little bit of a sleight of hand thing, and I think it is a very incumbent on us to understand fully what we're doing so that we're doing something that's legitimate and sustainable, and I am appreciative of the work of DHS to, you know, make sure that we don't get ourselves into trouble, and I know they work hard to make sure that we don't. So this has a little ways to go, but I appreciate the sentiment here, which is how do we get more funding into our Medicaid rates that are so necessary to support this service. So I think that's the kind of the bottom line on this, as I'm understanding. Any other discussion from members? Not seeing any. I don't know if everybody wants to go home or what, but anyway, final word, Representative Hewitt.
Only a couple minutes closing here.
Make it an hour.
Well, Representative Backer, you are who I'm going to talk about, because we heard a lot about funding tonight with EMS. If we took Representative Backer's service that they provide and we made them into a full-time ideal BLS service, we would have to charge $8,750 for every call you went on. Right now, we charge less than probably $1,000, maybe $1,500 sometimes. They're now being reimbursed anywhere near to putting them as a full-time service. We're in trouble. The tsunami's coming. We have services tonight that I don't know if they're going to answer the pager. So I'm going to need your help to continue these discussions, to hopefully get somewhere. We get this on the track and from both sides of the aisle. This is a very serious issue. Thank you, Madam Chair, for this great night. I had a great time. I'm sure these wonderful people behind me. And so thank you for considering the bills.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Representative Hewitt. I don't think people realize this is what we do for fun. Not really. Some of us more than others, maybe. But really appreciate the bill. And with that, House File 643, as amended, is laid over for possible inclusion. And I would just, Representative Hewitt, thank you very much for bringing all these bills and for your continued work on this very difficult issue. And really, again, appreciate everyone who came out tonight to listen to this and to help us do better for all Minnesotans, because that is, after all, our job, to make sure that people have the basics and they can should be able to live comfortably in any part of our state and have the basic services they need. So we appreciate your help on this, Representative Hewitt. And with that, we are adjourned.